Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the travel rug on my parcel shelf.
It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
That's a belter.
Do you like that?
Well, I do.
Now, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, travel rug.
How are you, mate?
I'm all right, thank you. But more to the point, how are you? Because we're getting into the business end of your year, aren't we? Because you're back on track. How was it?
Yeah. Do you know what? It's going well. I'm driving a Honda, which has been the enemy for many, many, many years.
Have you never, ever driven a Honda?
I've never been near one.
Oh, wow. I never thought about that. Of course, yeah, because
it's the enemy. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know what? And I have to give credit where it's due. Team Dynamics, which is Matt Neal's team, they build the Hondas, and they do actually build a really sexy car, actually. It's lovely. You know, underneath, it's done properly. So, yeah, I mean, it's going well. We're quick. The car feels great. And we've, you know, I've exchanged a smile with Matt Neal over a pit wall.
Very good.
But early days, but let's see how we crack on. But yeah, we should be looking good this year.
Good. Well, listen, talking of cracking on, we have a guest awaiting in the wings.
We do. And this guest, well, he's a gentleman that's particularly difficult to pigeonhole. He's a presenter, a comedian, a former Top Gear researcher, and someone you would have seen on The One Show and heard on the radio talking about everything from, if the script is correct, scalextrics to breast milk. But underpinning all of that is a vast spectrum of knowledge and expertise. He's an out-and-out car nut whose greatest role, surely, is one of the half of the presenting team on The Car Years. It is, of course, Mr. Alex Riley. Hi, mate. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. My breast milk years, I think, may be behind me, but thank you for drawing my attention to that. It's delicious, yes, by the way. I think I'll probably live forever because that stuff is good for you, man.
Yeah.
I think it would be remiss of us not to explain this slightly better for those that may have just tuned in, because, of course, I've done this research in terms of your, and I'm going to say in its eclectic career, Alex, because I think it is in many ways, but certainly breast milk featured in my research. Please explain to Jason why.
Okay, well, I did a series of documentaries for the BBC. One of them was called Britain's Really Disgusting Foods. There was a series of them, and we did one about dairy, and we were looking at the way that the supermarkets weren't paying farmers enough money for their milk, and a lot of them were going out of business, and so we did a big thing about this, but also we also said that, okay, well, maybe we need to look at alternative sources of milk, and
I've got images of things in my head now.
I went to like a sort of a mother and baby get together, and offered them a role in my breast milk organisation. And
and did you have a name for this enterprise?
Yes. Now let me just think. It was called Mama Riley's, I think. Mama Riley's breast milk. And I went to Asda. I went to Asda in Leeds and did a presentation to one of their sort of chilled goods buyers, and tried to sign them up to stock my product, the breast milk product.
And presumably this clip, this spoof, is on some sort of tube on the internet.
I think
somewhere,
so,
is it?
Yes. I think
I've
so,
got to
yes.
watch that.
Alex, this is just one part of your interesting journey into showbiz, and I hope you don't mind me using the word interesting, but as I say, it's not an orthodox route necessarily. Give us a quick whistle stop, because obviously we want to talk about how you got into the car presenting, but I think we need to have the backstory before that. So what's a quick whistle stop story between you and getting into show business as such?
Well, I was always interested in performing and making people laugh and that sort of thing, so I did lots of youth theatre and plays, acting, performing, doing whatever. And then I ended up, you know, just doing normal jobs for several years, feeling more and more frustrated. And but alongside that, I'd always been obsessed with cars.
Yeah.
And then on Top Gear one Thursday night, they kind of put out an appeal and said, would you like to come and live in leafy Birmingham and be a researcher on Top Gear? And I thought, oh my goodness, this, if ever I wanted to work in television, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. And then Jeremy Clarkson left after about 6 months. And it was before that, I'd obviously been trying to make people laugh and stuff in the office, and they'd said, oh, yeah, maybe we should try you on the programme. I'm like, yes! And then Jeremy Clarkson left, and then the BBC suddenly noticed the motoring unit and started to sort of take a great deal of interest in what it was doing. And so everything was under scrutiny, and you know, that we didn't have any freedom to try things out and do things, and it was all a bit crazy. So it took about 3 years before I eventually did get the chance to present. So I did three items on Top Gear, and then I did about three or four items on Top Gear GTI, which was a sort of spin-off programme that was on UK TV or something.
So, Alex, the love of cars, I mean, would it be fair to say Top Gear fueled that? Or, you know, in your childhood, were cars always a thing that sexed you up?
I can't remember a time when I haven't been absolutely obsessed with cars. Right, I mean, it's just been... I mean, people always say, well, was there an experience or a thing that made you... And I just can't think of a thing that... I can't remember not being just absolutely fascinated by all cars. Right. And then, you know, I watched things like The Persuaders and The New Avengers and all these kind of exciting TV shows where they had glamorous cars and there was a glamorous lifestyle sort of associated with these cars. And so I found that very appealing. But I just started buying car magazines when I was about 10 or 11. Street Machine and Custom Car occasionally, which at the time had topless ladies on the cover, actually on the cover and inside. So that was quite an exciting thing to do.
Oh, how the world has changed.
Taking it home wrapped up in a copy of the Beano.
Even now with that sort of thing, they covered parts of it up. They didn't then. I don't understand how it got through anyway. And then when I was 13 on holiday, I found a copy of Car magazine, and that completely changed my life. I couldn't believe the quality of the writing about cars. It kind of just made the whole thing seem really important and fascinating. And it wasn't trivial and banal. It was kind of really incisive, and it opened up this whole world. And I've bought every issue since. And I think I've got every issue now since about 1965, and most of the issues before that. Wow. Yeah. And I just, I love reading in general, and I love reading about cars, So doing the car years is fantastic for me because I've got 8 programs and 8 cars to research and find out all the interesting stories about, and then to write a script and sort of, because it's kind of like generally you're making a case for the car. You're really trying to think why it was so important, why it was so crucial, and why it could have been a disaster, but they managed to pull it out of the back, and it just, I love it. And also you get to dress up.
Yeah, absolutely. For those that haven't seen it, The Car Years is obviously yourself and Vicky Butler-Henderson, and you take a year and you pick a car each from that year, and then you have to argue the point as to which is the best or the most significant or the most important, et cetera, et cetera, and then a panel votes on that. But it's really interesting because, listen, we're all into cars. That's a sort of prerequisite of actually being here as part of this club. But it's really interesting listening to the backstory and the history on why that came around, or why it was designed in such a way, and et cetera, et cetera. It's quite an educational program, I would say.
Well, I think the thing about car TV, it's kind of gone down a bit of a cul-de-sac where it's all about doing cars up and buying and selling them. And while that is interesting, I mean, I love to see people kind of transforming a car with problems into something that's pristine again. For me, I love the stories and cars that have, now, an Aston Martin DB5 is, £1 million. When it was new and when it was 10 years old, it was not worth that much. It was worth the same as another car of a similar stripe. Worth nothing like as much. So if you take them back right to the start and go behind the scenes in the company, and the company's like, okay, we're in trouble. We're in terrible trouble. We need to pull something out of the bag here. Otherwise, the company is going to fail. Then suddenly, in the new series, we do a car called the BMW 600, which is, you probably don't know about it because it was only on sale for 2 years, from 1957 to 1959. And it wasn't a success. But what it represented in terms of the history of BMW, because at the end of the war, two of their factories were behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
And another one had been destroyed, and the what was left, the Allies confiscated all the machine tools and presses and everything. They were literally using, people were making pots and pans by hand. BMW was building locks for gates and pots and pans.
Wow.
And think about where they are now.
Yeah.
And it was a, you know, from 1947 or something, when they were allowed to start making motorbikes, right through until about the end of the 50s, start of the 60s, they were hanging by a thread. They were in terrible trouble, and they kept trying new things to we'll make the Isetta bubble car. That'll be great. Yeah. That'll save the company. But you don't make any money on a bubble car, do you? And they had these tiny volume luxury cars at the top end that sold in their hundreds, let alone thousands, and then a bubble car and nothing in the middle. Where Germany was suddenly going through this kind of economic miracle where it, you know, people wanted to buy cars, but they couldn't buy a BMW. They were buying hundreds of thousands of Beetles, and BMW were just hemorrhaging money and being threatened with takeover by the Roots Group. The Roots Group were interested in BMW. Right? Hillman, you know, were going to buy BMW. And the only reason they wanted to buy it was to get hold of their dealers in Europe. They weren't interested in anything else.
They wanted the network.
Yeah. So in that sense, you know, gosh, it's a fascinating story. And it's like the jeopardy involved in creating this car or that car. So it's just a great story, you know.
Yeah. And what was the Fiat 600 pitched against on the show?
The Fiat 500. So two kind of, you know, economy cars for people who were moving from a motorbike and sidecar or a Vespa.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that they could now afford a car. And, you know, Fiat had got the 600 as well, and then the NSU 600, and the Beetle was doing really well. So it was all this kind of the people who could afford their very first car. Mm. What were they going to do? And, you know, it's just fascinating. It's fascinating.
Talking of first cars, what was yours then, Alex?
Well, the first car I ever had any ownership of was a Vauxhall Viva HC. Ooh. That belonged to a lad in my class at school, Coxie. And do you know him, Coxie? No, probably not known. Anyway, me and Pete, we wanted to build a rally car. So we thought, well, you know, a Vauxhall Viva is rear-wheel drive. It's going to be a good rally car. So we bought it, about 120 quid. Now, instead of just kind of insuring it and pumping the tyres up and doing like a kind of a road rally with the local motor club, we decided we had to take it back to bare metal. Having no mechanical attitude or knowledge whatsoever, we started basically dismantling the thing, tearing out the interior, ripping off the trim. We were crazy. And we were trying to get the grill off. I don't know why we wanted to get the grill off. We drove it once. Anyway, we tried to get the grill off, and we said, well, we can't get this screw off. Let's break it off with a chisel.
Angle grinder it out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because I'd heard somebody say, oh, I had to break it off. So we did it. And as the more we hit it, a bigger crack appeared in the inner wing. And it turned out that the inner wing was made of papier-mâché. It was just basically newspapers glued together and sprayed with blue paint. So basically, the engine bay fell off, and we had to scrap it. And we thought, because it got row style wheels, we might get a few quid for it. But I think we got 30 quid for it or something. The bloke took it away. So that was not a great episode. But the first sort of real car that I had was a Citroen Visa 14 TRS, 1360 cc. With a 5-speed gearbox. And I had this job one summer selling aerial photographs in Lincolnshire. And you needed a car. So I bought this car. I'd worked for a year and I'd saved up some money. So I bought this car, and it was the most unreliable car ever made. I was driving it away from the bloke's house, and the clutch cable came off the clutch pedal before I got more than a mile away, and that was just the start of it. So I got quite good at hooking the wire back on the clutch pedal. But then I don't think it had been used much. It was only about 3 or 4 years old. But it turned out the radiator was like full of rust. So I'd be in Lincolnshire in the height of the summer, and I'd set off going, and suddenly the temperature gauge would start to sort of creep up a bit. Mm. So I'd put the heater on, number one.
That's a good old trick, that, isn't it? Try and suck some heat out of it. I like that.
And then I'd drop all four windows, and I'd be there with sweat pouring off me. I was wearing wool trousers because you had to look smart, but it was the height of summer. And then, oh no, there's a red light. Oh, crikey. Pull up to the traffic lights within about 25 seconds. The whole thing would boil, and then the water would escape from the radiator and drench the distributor, and the car would cut out, and I'd be stranded in the middle of the road. So it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. And I made no money whatsoever from selling aerial photographs. So I ended up in debt. So, yeah, it was a disaster. And I bought it for 1,500 quid and sold it for 500 at an auction.
I mean, I think that's an interesting choice of first car, actually. It wasn't where I thought you were going to go. Where does it progress after that? Does it stay continental, or do you come a bit closer to home and what's known?
I think after that, I had a Ford Orion 1.3L.
Okay. That's what I thought. I thought you'd play a bit safer and closer to home.
Basically, the Citroën, obviously I was a massive fan of car magazine. So I was interested in all sorts of Citroëns and Alfa Romeos and anything that most people ran a mile from.
Yeah.
I just thought these were fascinating. These were brilliant cars. Also, it was a B-Reg and it had got a 5-speed box. And in those days, a 5-speed gearbox seemed like incredibly exotic.
Yeah.
And I was going to buy a Metro because I'm massively into my Austin Rover and BL, but I could only afford, obviously they were only 4 speeds. And I just thought, I wish I'd have bought the Metro now, flipping out. It would have been much better. 1.3S for 1,000 quid. I could have saved 500 quid and it would have probably been much easier to look after. But anyway, so then some friend of the family, he'd had an Orion from new and absolutely looked after it perfectly. So he was getting rid of that. So I bought that. But that wasn't very exciting at all. I used to have a radio cassette player, but on the passenger seat, so I could listen to tape, AM radio, whatever. And it had at one point the vacuum advance broke on the distributor, and it's a bizarre, driving a car like that is bizarre because basically you're driving along, you've got no power whatsoever, you're just kind of moving. And then if you put your foot flat to the floor, the last millimeter of travel, all the power comes in at once. And you're like, whoa! It's amazing. It's like, what the hell? It's like a turbo or something. But yeah.
So what came after the Orion?
The Orion. Well, I got a company car after that, I think. Which was a Fiat Bravo, or the GT as it was called in European markets, but for insurance purposes, it was called the HLX. It had amazing, on the radio cassette, there was the lid of the tape player kind of came up and out. It was like a really amazing, cool feature. And it had heated seats and it was great. I really liked it. It sounded fantastic when you revved it. 113 horsepower. So it wasn't mega fast, but
not a bad looking car, actually.
Very, very nice. But before that, I had a 205 GTI.
Oh, now we're talking.
1.6 or 1.9?
1.6, the sweet spot, I think you'll find. 1.6. Yeah.
I think you'll find. Hey, they were great, weren't they?
Oh, I mean, it was such a contrast to an Orion. or whatever I had before that. I think, because it was like about under 900 kilograms.
Yeah.
And it had a 1.6 engine. And that, at the time, that just seemed like a huge engine for such a small car. And because it was so light, the torque of the 1.6, you just had instant performance at any revs. It was...
They were fantastic, eh?
Yeah. Steering on those is just beautiful.
Do you know what? When was the last time you were in one? Have you driven one relatively recently?
No, not since then.
I drove one 2 years ago. We were doing the new, a new Peugeot 20 whatever GTI, and we managed to get an old one, which was pristine. Oh my God, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Did it feel fast anymore?
It did.
Did it really?
The one thing which struck me, apart from, you know, how go-karty it was and how much fun, was just how airy it was inside.
Yeah.
There's glass everywhere, and it was literally like you were sat in it in a greenhouse. You had fantastic visibility. It was just brilliant. I loved it.
No, the reason I asked you a question is that when you look back now on sort of, you know, brake horsepower figures and stuff from what we always perceive to be rocket fast, you know, years ago, and you look at them now and you sort of go, well, a standard 1.2 or something is going to have more guts than that. Because, I mean, these GTIs were, whatever, 120, 130 brake and stuff. It wasn't much, was it?
But very light.
115, that one, actually. They're 1.6. Starts off with 105, and then he got 115 to keep pace with the 5 GT turbo. I think the point is that, you know, it's older cars feel faster anyway than modern cars because, as you say, it's very airy in there. Yeah. You've got all that space around you, and it's light, you know, and it, I don't know, the engine, you can hear the engine going up through the red. You can, everything seems to be more mechanical, and you get just more feedback that helps. Yeah. You know, a lot of modern cars are faster, but they don't feel fast. You're cocooned and separated from the
engine. Almost insulated from the experience in modern stuff, aren't you? I mean, that you know, those 205s were, the GTIs were fantastic driver's cars. Yeah.
So that's the inner petrol head, obviously, coming out there, Alex Riley, and showing itself. So where does it progress? I can see some of your car magazines coming into play here, and you're now thinking about owning some of the stuff that you read about.
Well, obviously, I am very keen on the Triumph TR7. Okay. As a child, that was very much an exciting car because, you know, back in the 70s, you know, you didn't see exotic cars around. You saw lots of bread and butter cars, and the more exotic cars were on TV programs or in, we had this figurine Panini album called Sport Auto that had all sorts of De Tomasos and Monteverdis and amazing exotica in. And but the TR7, you know, not only did it have just two seats, it had this amazing wedge shape and the pop-up headlights, and it was completely modern. There was nothing old-fashioned and boring about it. And so that, my brother, one Saturday morning, went to town and got a brochure. And I just absolutely fell in love with it from that day on. And then I'd be looking for them on the road or in TV shows. They would crop up as for minor characters in things like Return of the Saint. And Purdy had one or possibly two in the new Avengers. And I always wanted one. When I was on Top Gear, I nearly bought one and for some reason didn't get around to it. And then several years later, I had a Saab and I wrote it off at the end of my road with a bus. And I was thinking of getting an Alpha 156. And then I thought, you know, I'm a single man. I don't have a family. Why do I want like a four-door saloon? You know, if I'm ever going to get something a bit daft, now's the time to do it. So I bought this TR7 and then used it as my only car until we had kids. And, you know, I've still got it now.
Have you? Wow, fantastic.
I know. And it hasn't turned a wheel for a couple of years because I keep having trouble with my garage. And I keep trying to fix it. And then then it breaks again. Anyway, I'm going to get it done this summer. I'm going to get the carriage fixed and then I'll get it recommissioned because it's just a lovely car to drive. You know, so underrated. Now people have a very different attitude to them. You know, people are like, wow, what's that? And gosh, that looks amazing. I thought these had all disappeared. And, you know, so it's just, it's quite a practical car, actually. It's very spacious inside. I'm 6'4" and I fit. I can't even have the seat all the way back. It's got a big boot. It's got a 5-speed gearbox. You know, I've done lots of miles in it.
I can remember as a kid lusting after one because they were so different when it first came, you know, there's the TR6 before. And this was a huge step forward, wasn't it, in design? And
absolutely. But it's one of those cars that's been sort of maligned and misunderstood and deliberately misinterpreted. And I don't know, I quite like the underdog. I'm much more, when I'm writing a story for the Car Years, there's nothing worse than a car that was really good and was really successful. And that was it. There's so little to write about.
Yeah, you need Jeopardy, don't you?
You need Jeopardy, or you need a car that was too far ahead of its time and it ultimately failed, but it was a brilliant idea, but they just couldn't quite make it work. Or, you know, so the TR7, you know, arrived at the worst possible period for the British motor industry, when it was in a terrible state. It was rushed into production before it had been finally developed and honed. And people just set out to misunderstand it. And then the other cars in the range were never launched. So there's just so much to love about the story and the what ifs and could have beens and might have beens. And, you know, and it's just a great car in itself, you know, and you can actually improve it quite simply with a few little tweaks and things. And, you know, people, there was somebody on Twitter recently who sort of said, oh, no, I've never driven a TR7. I imagine it's like slower than an MGB and not as good. And I just like, so what I did was I went to one of my old car magazines from 1980, MGB GT versus TR7, and just photographed performance figures and part of the conclusion, which was damning towards the MGB and emphatically positive in favour of the TR7. And the performance figures were miles ahead. And I just said, I'll leave this here.
Defence rests case.
No further questions, Your Honour.
Talking of which, do you remember Tony Pond back in the rally days? They had a V8 version of that car, didn't they?
That's right, yeah.
Which is the SDI engine.
That's right, over 300 horsepower. Devastatingly quick on tarmac, you know, and also, of course, I'm going to tell you that for 1981, they had all these extra developments coming for the rally car that would have seen it, you know, move a whole step more. And then I start thinking about, okay, what if they homologated it for Group B? What would the regulations have said for Group B? What could have happened? And actually, you know, I think it could have been competitive, certainly up until 1980, end of 82, because like an Opel Ascona won the driver's championship, I think, you know, two-wheel drive.
And this
had a lot more performance and the development was coming through. So, yeah, I mean, and he's one of the most underrated rally drivers ever. I mean,
absolutely, yeah.
He in fact, he got offered a works drive for Toyota, I think, but they refused to build him a right-hand drive car. And so he walked away.
Is that right?
Yeah, he had a full, you know, a full World Rally Car program lined up, and then he refused. I don't know if he lacked confidence in himself, but his co-driver went on to drive with some, you know, Juha Kankkonen and all that, and he said Pond was as good as any of them, of them.
Alex, what is the motoring itch that you're yet to scratch?
Good question.
Well, I would very much like to have a Lotus Elite, which is almost like the sort of the grown-up TR7 from the 70s. And I was chatting to the people at Lotus Bits recently about some amazing developments that they've done on the engines and the electric system and the chassis. And also they'll build you like this amazing kind of 235 horsepower engine that's beautifully smooth and economical and everything. And so I would really like that. I do like that kind of wedge aesthetic. But one of my all-time favourite cars is the Citroën SM, and I've been lucky enough to drive a couple of them. And there's a guy in France, it's a business called SM2A, and they are the kind of world specialists on Citroën SMs. And they make this SM2, which is kind of like, I hesitate to call it a resto mod because that, I don't know, that makes me think of like American muscle cars with 23-inch wheels on it and garish paint and chrome everywhere. But he basically takes the SM, and there are one or two little reliability things on the engine that can cause problems, and he kind of cures all those. And then he tidies up all the hydropneumatic piping and everything. And removes 130 kilograms of weight from it.
Is that? Wow.
And a lot of that is ahead of the front wheels. So it puts more of the weight between the axles. And then he polishes the engine up so that it produces another 30 horsepower approximately. And then he's had the wheels 3D scanned and remade 5 kilograms per wheel lighter.
Wow, per wheel. Good Lord.
Per wheel. And it's 17 inches instead of 15 inches, I think. So And as you know, Jason, you know, in terms of rotational inertia, unsprung weight, unsprung mass, it makes such a difference to keeping the contact patch in with the road surface. And the interior, is just kind of the leather. It looks exactly like a normal one, except the leather looks much, much more high quality, thick, pliant, with an Alcantara middle. I mean, it already looks a bit like Hugh Hefner's penthouse apartment from 1983 in Manhattan. It's absolutely stunning. I mean, it's about 300 grand. That's the trouble. Anything that's, any of these things are 300,000 quid. So, but it already, even in its standard form, it is such a wonderful car to drive. I was on the car years, and I was sat in it waiting for the call to do some driving past the camera, and I just sat there in my 1970 velvet jacket with all my gear on, just thinking, you know, this is the perfect car for me. This is where it's at. I could take the family out in it. I could go to Geneva tonight and not be tired. It's such a wonderful piece of equipment. And, you know, as you drive it, the faster you go, the assistance on the steering reduces. So it suddenly gets just, but in a ratio that just feels perfectly sensible.
It's a beautiful thing, that SM, isn't it? It's a great car. Palomine's got an original one, and he loves it. He takes it out, you know, and does trips to, you know, he often does a little trip with him and her indoors, and they go down to France and buy some cheese and get some wine, and they do a little, and they just do a little trip, maybe twice a year. And his is in a dark green. It's just beautiful. Great cars.
I bet you when he's there, I met a guy with one, and he said he goes to France in it, and he said, oh, they treat you like a celebrity.
Yeah, like royalty, yeah.
Do they?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's just like it was the epitome of French prestige and luxury. And, you know, for a long time, French cars had been the pinnacle of kind of luxury, the grand routiers, and they didn't have one for many years. And then the SM came, and everybody went mad for it, and it was the return to that. And then, of course, it disappeared again, and they didn't have another car like that again for a very long time. So it is like part of their pride in being French, I think.
Alex, as a man who likes his nostalgia, where do you stand on the future and electric cars? Can you see yourself in one?
At the moment, I can't see myself in one. My dream is that I keep reading about synthetic fuels, zero CO2 fuels.
Yeah.
Something in Autocar this week about it. And I think the thing about electric cars at the moment is, you know, they're so heavy. They're so big to cover the battery. They're actually huge, a lot of them. To get the big batteries, they have to be 5 meters long and 2.5 meters wide or something. And also, you know, if you compare it like to like with a petrol car equivalent, you're looking at sort of 250 to 500 kilograms of additional weight. And so that means that in terms of manufacturing, the energy and resources and CO2 is considerably more. Now, in operation, that obviously reduces because you know, the electricity isn't using as much CO2 to be generated, but it takes several years to offset that. Now, so we're trying to reduce CO2. So what we're going to do if we replace all petrol cars with electric cars is, for a good few years, cause a massive increase in the amount of CO2 produced. So I think at the moment, it's not for me. Perhaps in the future it will be, you know, when batteries become much more energy dense and, it's not, and the charging becomes a lot faster and a lot more convenient and that. But for now, I think, I mean, I've got my regular daily driver is a 2006 Mazda with 176,000 miles on the clock. And I think that's quite a green option, really. You know, how many?
Good point.
If you've been doing PCPs since 2006, I mean, how many cars would you have actually built? For that, you know, I mean, it's ludicrous, isn't it? In fact, there's a very famous environmentalist, and I think he's got like a diesel super mini that he's had for about 12 years or something. And he says that's, you know, that's the best way. Don't build a new car when this has still got life in it, you know. So,
And what's the situation regarding synthetic fuels as we stand at the moment? I mean, are we on the brink of that, or?
Well, I think there are people investing in developing it. There's a university in this country that are looking to use methanol to create hydrogen in a car or something. I'm not a scientist. I'm not an expert on this, but I know Porsche are developing synthetic fuels, and I know that Formula One are going to go with synthetic fuels in a few years' time. So
I think you're right. I think it will come, and I think that will be the best solution, because you still will retain similar sorts of energy density that you get from a hydrocarbon fuel, and a battery will never in 100 years be anywhere near energy dense enough to make a difference.
But also, I think it's just the fact that, you know, you're able to, you know, continue using and reuse existing product, you know, because the whole wastefulness of just suddenly making a whole fleet of cars completely obsolete by a certain date and saying, right, well, you can no longer drive them, is that's not environmentally friendly by any stretch, because they've got to be disposed of.
I think you're absolutely right.
And all the petrol stations, what are we going to do with those? You know, absolutely. They've got tanks in the ground, they pump liquid. Well, let's just create a liquid which is environmentally friendly. And I think that's going to be the future.
And a liquid, you can pump that quite quickly, can't you? You don't have to. And if there is a queue, you know, the queue, people move on in 5 minutes. And I think electric would be great for, I think, delivery vans, anything like urban, you know, like scaffolders. crappy vans that nobody has service, that belch out, they leave the engine running all day.
Yeah.
While they're eating their sandwiches and while they're doing whatever and on their phone, turning the engine on to charge their blooming phone up. I mean, that's mental. And, you know, little people dropping off packages and stuff like that. And all this, get rid of that, because urban, you know, we don't want all the particulates and all that in an urban environment. For everything else, surely there has to be a more sensible solution, I think. I don't know.
And anyone that's into cars and has got a knowledge like we have, we should be given a special license to always drive V8, V10s or even V12s. And also to use the empty lane on the left-hand side of motorways.
Yes.
That should be ours.
Yeah. Well, we should have our own heritage class, shouldn't we? You know, whereby we're exempt to the ordinary rules of society, where, as you say, we can do and indeed drive what we like, when we like, and as fast as we like.
And this is not just in terms of cars. This is in all laws
general
and regulations
behavior. Yes.
Apply to us. Yes. I think that seems... Should we start a political party?
I think so. All in favour? Yeah.
So, Alex, music and cars, they go particularly well together. So, I want your fancy drive. Where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you driving?
Well, you know, it would have been nice if you'd have given me a bit of time to think about this one. You know, putting me on the spot like that with it. I mean, how many questions were there? About four questions in that, really. Well, I mean, a Citroen SM, I think that'd be quite nice. Yeah. Drive. It's got to be a cross-continental drive, possibly to get to a casino or to solve a crime.
At a casino?
A casino-based crime, yes. Mm. So that's what I would do. And I'd be listening. I mean, a journey like that, I mean, I'd have to have a lot of CDs in the car for that, wouldn't I? I mean, it's... I mean, how many hours is it going to take me to get down to possibly the Italian Riviera? It's going to take hours.
Days.
That's a lot of albums.
Yeah.
Days. Yeah, I'm going to stop off to meet beautiful women in various different locations on the way, obviously, and eat fine foods, drink fine wines. And what am I listening to? Well, I mean, I like very much like music of the 1960s and 70s. And I just purchased an Air CD from a charity shop in Sheffield for 50p. Walkie Talkie, it's called. It's very good. Very good driving music.
I'm going to write this down.
Yeah. It's just nice, atmospheric, optimistic music. Very good.
And,
yes.
You know, you don't really have to pick which one of those albums you listen to, because, quite frankly, you'll have time to listen to all of them on the way down to the Italian Riviera while stopping off at lakeside luncheon places with beautiful women.
Yes, actually, once when I was on Top Gear, I had a Jaguar XK8 for the weekend, and it had a CD auto changer in the boot, which I'd love one now. I've only got the CD in the Mazda because it's so old, and I had a John Barry soundtracks CD. Yes. And I slipped that on, and it was all the Ipcress file and Bond themes. And honestly, I was Bond. I was driving through the night up the A38 to Sheffield from Birmingham. And I was just this playboy, crime-fighting man of mystery.
And on that note, Jason, I think we have to get out of here.
Well, that's about it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs, help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thank you. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Alex Riley. Thanks, mate.
Cheers, thanks.
Very, very nice. Already, I want to come on a continental road trip with you, actually, in that SM. That would be fun. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plater or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Ta-da.